This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
Good afternoon. I'm Katarina Harvati, and it's a pleasure to be here. And as already mentioned, I'd like to talk today about the modern human expansion out of Africa. So as we already heard today, modern humans first evolved in Africa, with the earliest representatives of our species already found more than 300 or close to 300,000 years ago. However, today we exist everywhere on the globe as an extremely geographically widespread and ecologically tolerant species. And one of the central questions in modern human origins research, aside from pinpointing the time and place of origin, is also how this situation came to exist. So, important questions, for example, include: when and how did Homo sapiens disperse out of the African continent? What were the critical factors enabling this dispersal, whether they might be ecological or demographic, social, cultural, technological? What was the possible interaction between early modern humans dispersing out of Africa and archaic hominins already living in Eurasia? And what are the possible impacts that this might have had? And so on. But the very first question that we must answer before addressing anything else is, when and how did Homo sapiens disperse out of Africa? And this is what I'd like to talk about today. So what do we know? As we already heard in the previous talks, early modern humans emerge in Africa starting around 300,000 years ago and are found all over the continent. But at this time, during this time frame, we also have archaic hominins, other species that exist in Eurasia. So we have the Neanderthal evolution taking place in Western Eurasia, starting already before 300,000 years ago and ending with the Neanderthal disappearance around 39,000 years ago. We also have Denisovans that exist in East Asia, possibly also in Southeast Asia, and we have late surviving Homo erectus in Southeast Asia. We also know that the main expansion of Homo sapiens out of Africa started between 70 and 50,000 years before present, with modern humans reaching Australia as early as 50,000 years ago, and then slightly later reaching northern parts of East Asia as well as Europe around 45,000 years ago, finally arriving in the New World around between 20 and 15,000 years before present, and from there really covering the rest of the planet. And this dispersal really sets the stage for the world as we know it today. However, the story is not so simple. We have known for many years that Homo sapiens dispersed out of Africa already in an earlier migration wave. We have evidence from the Near East, from the sites of Skul and Kafse, that shows early Homo sapiens arriving there between 130 and 100,000 years before present. Recent evidence from a nearby Misliya cave site has put this early dispersal of Homo sapiens into the Levant at an even earlier date, close to 180,000 years before present. What's more, in later periods, so after 100,000, there are Neanderthals found in the same region, and no longer early modern humans, suggesting that these early Homo sapiens did not persist in the long term in this region, but they were rather perhaps replaced by Neanderthals here, until the later main out of Africa dispersal at 60,000 years before present. So what do we know about this early Homo sapiens dispersal? We know that it reached the Levant, possibly as early as 180,000 years before present. We generally consider it a failed dispersal, meaning that the populations of early modern humans did not actually stay, did not persist, did not survive in the long term, but were probably replaced by Neanderthals. This kind of dispersal might have been enabled by environmental shifts linked to the glacial cycle, such as the one that we heard about earlier from Jean-Jacques Hublin. And we also have phylogenetic evidence that suggests an ancient interbreeding event took place between Neanderthals and early modern human ancestors even before 200,000 years before present. So all of this basically means that we have been considering the Levant as a possible contact zone between Neanderthals and modern humans, where they might have encountered one another and possibly exchanged genes at this early time, but also later on in the main Out of Africa event. So this brings me to the site of Apidima and our recent work on the fossil human skulls from this site. Apidima is situated in the Mani Peninsula in southern Greece, at the southernmost point of mainland Greece that is shown here on the map inside the red circle. The site is a cave complex that was investigated in the late 1970s and 1980s by a team from the University of Athens Medical School. And it is during this work that two human fossil crania were discovered, encased in a block of rock, a breccia rock, found in the ceiling of one of the caves, Cave A, that is shown here. Now here you see the original photograph from the late 70s showing the rock in the ceiling, you see it here in red, where the human crania are encased and as it is about to be removed. And as you can see, this block of breccia is actually rather small and the two specimens were found very close to each other. The site itself could not be dated properly at the time of the discovery, but it was estimated that the skull breccia, this piece of rock containing the human remains, was between 150 to 400,000 years old. And a few years ago, a small fragment from one of the skulls, Apidima II, was dated to 150,000 years before present, approximately confirming this hypothesis. So despite their obvious importance, these fossil crania themselves remained unstudied and unpublished, and very little was known about them except preliminary assessments. Previous observations were made exclusively on one of these specimens, Apidima II, which is the one that is better preserved, so it actually has a face and most of the skull. All these observations were based on a handful of published measurements and a couple of published photographs, and it had been noticed that the specimen has Neanderthal or pre-Neanderthal affinities, but the specimen also suffered obviously from distortion and damage after death. As you can see here, it's rather crushed and distorted, so its interpretation was actually quite complicated. Now, the situation was even worse for the other human specimen, Apidima I, which is much less preserved, so there's a lot more of it missing, but it's not distorted. It was cleaned much later, so it was left inside the rock until approximately 2003 when it was cleaned and removed, and it was never described or published. No published photographs of it existed before. So approximately 2 years ago, I was approached by colleagues from the University of Athens Medical School who asked me to lead a new investigation and reanalysis of this important fossil material. So in this new analysis, what we did was we applied virtual anthropology methods to reconstruct the Apidima specimens virtually, and then we conducted exhaustive comparative analysis of their anatomy and their anatomical shape using the methods also mentioned previously, three-dimensional geomorphometrics, so that we could statistically analyze their shape and elucidate their affinities. Now, because the two crania preserve mostly different parts of the cranium, we had to mostly analyze them separately. But we conducted also a combined analysis, and I'm going to show you the results of this. And finally, we also applied new uranium series dating in order to shed light on the chronology and actually test the idea that the two specimens came from the same time period. What I didn't mention before is because they were found so close together, they were generally assumed that they lived roughly at the same time and they belonged to the same species and possibly even the same group. So we conducted dating analysis of the specimens themselves also to test this idea. Was it actually true? In this slide, you see the process of reconstruction or virtual reconstruction of the specimen Apidima II. And you see on the, on your left side, the 3D model derived from a CT scan. And in the middle, what you see is the segmentation, the virtual dissection of every bone fragment, so that we could then, in fact, isolate each bone fragment, clean the sediments from inside the cracks, and move the bone fragments back to the original correct anatomical position. And the final result you see on the other side, which is one of the reconstructions that we conducted. Because this kind of reconstruction, it could involve some error associated to different observers, we actually produced four different reconstructions by two different observers following two different criteria so that we could somehow correct for any observer error. The result was actually four quite similar reconstructions, and we use all of these reconstructions as well as their mean in our further analysis as individual specimens. Things were quite a lot simpler for Epidema 1. I mentioned to you before that it's not so well preserved, but it's not distorted. So the reconstruction of this specimen basically consisted of mirror imaging the better preserved side so as to have a more complete specimen to work with. So let's look at the results. Now we'll start with Epidema 2 because this is a specimen that is better known and had been studied somehow before. Its overall dimensions and cranial bone thickness indicate that it is an adult, and its linear measurements align it with Neanderthals, as it was previously stated in the literature. It has a whole suite of unique Neanderthal features present, including the morphology of its brow ridge and the morphology of the face, as well as details of its cranial anatomy. And what about if we actually statistically look at its shape? And you saw these sorts of plots before in Jean-Jacques' presentation. They are principal components analysis of 3D measurements. The one on the left is the facial based on measurements from the face, and the other one is based on 3D measurements from the rest of the skull. And what you see here, again, as you saw before, is modern humans shown in blue and Neanderthals all the way out here shown in red. And these yellow specimens are pre-Neanderthals, so European Middle Pleistocene, and the pink ones are early African, possibly Homo sapiens ancestors. So in both of these analyses, what we see is that Epidema 2 clusters with Neanderthals or between Neanderthals and pre-Neanderthals, exactly like it had been proposed before. We conducted also a classification analysis, and here you don't have to look at these numbers, but all you need to know is that Epidema 2 was classified in almost all cases as a Neanderthal with very high probability, and only in one case as a pre-Neanderthal, a Neanderthal ancestor. So, all in all, our results on this specimen agree with previous assessments of this skull. Now, turning to Epidema 1, now things are a little bit different. Again, the overall dimensions and cranial bone thickness indicate that it's an adult. And the part of the anatomy that it preserves, the back of the skull, actually should show quite a lot of unique Neanderthal features that are normally present in Neanderthals, but also pre-Neanderthals, in this anatomical region. Nevertheless, Epidema 1 shows none of these features. Instead, it shows a combination of ancestral and uniquely modern human features, and most strikingly, the feature that was already mentioned before, the rounded aspect of the back of the skull, which is something that we normally associate only with modern humans. Do these observations actually hold up when we analyze the shape in three dimensions? And here again, you see two different analyses, one based on 3D measurements reflecting overall neurocranial shape, and one specifically looking at the shape of the midline profile of the posterior part of the cranium. And again, you see modern humans in blue, Neanderthals in red, and earlier Middle Pleistocene Europeans here in yellow, and Middle Pleistocene Africans here in pink. And in both situations, again, you have in both analyses Epidema 1 plotting with the modern humans. Classification results are even more striking. In the neurocranial analysis, there's 100% posterior probability that Epidema 1 is a Homo sapiens, and in the mid-sagittal profile analysis, more than 90% posterior probability. We also conducted a combined shape analysis. This is the two specimens do not preserve a lot of the same morphology, but we wanted to see what they look like if we analyze them together, and we produced a reduced data set of only the measurements which we could measure on both of these specimens. And again, now the results are very similar to what we had before. Epidema 2 plotting within Neanderthals, Epidema 1 just outside the modern human polygon. Classification, very similar to what we had before. Epidema 2, more than 90% probability of being a Neanderthal, an abhidhamma one, more than 90% probability of being a modern human. So turning now to the new dates, and this was another surprise waiting for us. As I mentioned to you before, we applied the laser ablation uranium-thorium dating method, which is an appropriate method for this time period, and we applied it directly on fragments from Abhidhamma 1 as well as Abhidhamma 2, also on fragments of unidentifiable bone from the same block of breccia, as well as on the matrix, the sediment itself. So these are the results. The sediments, the matrix, date to approximately 150,000 years before present. What this means is that this is the time when the dirt, the ground around the specimens, solidified into rock. So you cannot really add anything to this block after this time, after this point in time. The unidentified bone fragments produce two clusters of dates, one around 160,000 years and one are more than 200,000 years before present. And the two human specimens fell roughly in these two clusters. Abhidhamma 2 dated to 170,000 years before present. Abhidhamma 1 dated to approximately 210,000 years ago. Now, this means that Abhidhamma 1 is older than Abhidhamma 2. So the early Homo sapiens is older than the Neanderthal in this site. And it also, of course, indicates that the final resting place where these specimens were recovered was not the original place of deposition. How do we explain this? Again, I remind you where the specimens were found, in a kind of crack in the ceiling, crack between rocks filled with this breccia bone, with this breccia rock. Now, the uranium uptake signatures and the different ages suggest that these two human fossils actually come from completely different parts of the cave, where they must have later been eroded and fell into a kind of fissure filling where they got thoroughly mixed in with the sediments solidifying around them at 150,000 years. So in conclusion, Abhidhamma 2 belongs to the Neanderthal lineage. It fits every expectation of Neanderthal evolution as we know it from the rest of Europe. Abhidhamma 1 does not. Instead, it possesses a combination of ancestral and modern human features, plots with and is classified as Homo sapiens, is always closest in overall shape to modern human individuals. So there must have been two populations living in what is now southern Greece in the Middle Pleistocene, an early Homo sapiens group, approximately at 210,000 years before present, followed by a Neanderthal population at least 170,000 years ago. So, in fact, the situation, as it's shown by the Abhidhamma fossils, seems to be rather similar to what we have in the Levant, where early modern humans appear to have dispersed early. And in my view, actually, Abhidhamma 1 probably represents the same dispersal wave as the Mizliya specimen in Israel. Furthermore, in both regions, early modern humans seems to not have persisted in the long term, with Neanderthal populations appearing and sort of replacing modern humans in both of these regions, as is shown in Greece by the Abhidhamma 2 fossil, but also by other sites exactly in the neighborhood, such as Kalamagia and Lagonis, that have also produced Neanderthal remains. So what are the implications now for modern human origins? This work shows that the early dispersal of Homo sapiens out of Africa occurred earlier and reached much further than previously thought, reaching Europe by 150,000 years earlier than previously suspected. This fits well with evidence from Israel, where we have Homo sapiens presence by 180,000 years ago. It also fits with genetic evidence that has suggested an ancient interbreeding event between Neanderthals and modern humans before 200,000 years. So this work actually creates quite a lot of new questions. One of the most important ones, perhaps, is, was this a failed dispersal? And if so, why? Why did modern humans not persist? Why did they not survive in these regions like they did later on with a later dispersal out of Africa? But in my view, of course, one of the most important implications is that perhaps we should consider the broader Eastern Mediterranean region as a possible contact zone between Neanderthals and modern humans. And with this, I would like to thank all my collaborators and team members, as well as all the funding agencies, and of course you for your attention.
Thank you. Welcome. And I'd like to start by thanking the organizers of this symposium and CARTA for inviting us and hosting us for this session. Our goal today is to look back at our origins and ask how, where, and when one species of African hominin gained the ability to spread across Africa into Eurasia, replacing all of its hominin relatives. I investigate through archaeology, the material remains of ancient human behavior. To investigate today's topic, generally archaeologists have looked for evidence of complex cognition, including the use of language, symbols, and cumulative culture. Ornaments, beads, representational works, abstract designs, and complex technologies are thought to be indicative. When tracking the development of these complex behaviors, we can look for evidence of continuity or punctuation, the tempo of evolution. Broadly speaking, the African archaeological record for the period of interest has been divided into three phases, primarily based on characteristics of stone tool technologies: the earlier Stone Age or Acheulean, the Middle Stone Age, and the later Stone Age. The timing of the transition from one to the next are active areas of investigation and may not be synchronous across all regions of Africa. Much of the discussion about modern human origins has focused on the middle to later Stone Age transition, so we can begin here. The typical MSA is characterized by largish flakes struck from prepared cores. The resulting flakes, flake blades, and points were subject to varying forms and degree of retouch or reshaping, although often less than what is seen in Mousterian assemblages created by Neanderthals. Occasionally, for discrete periods of time, there are more specific shaped pieces, such as this backed segment or crescent. The later Stone Age is often characterized by hafted microlithic tools and numerous implements made out of bone, such as these bone points. Importantly, in the LSA, people are ubiquitously making pendants and beads out of shell, bone, and ostrich eggshell, and many argue that these non-lithic artifacts are really the basis of the striking contrast with the Middle Stone Age. MSA people had many advanced behaviors, such as sophisticated stone flaking, active hunting, pigment collection, and the control of fire. However, some have argued that they were not fully modern. These colleagues have argued that items indicating complex symbolic behaviors, such as these ostrich eggshell beads, don't appear until late in the record, appearing abruptly about 50,000 years ago and marking the onset of the later Stone Age. Some colleagues have argued that biological evolution stimulated these abrupt changes, while others think that technological, sociocultural, and demographic changes provide sufficient explanations. Even while some colleagues were arguing for the punctuated appearance of modern behaviors with the start of the later Stone Age, others found evidence for more complex behaviors within the MSA. These researchers focused on the complexity of stone tool technologies and the abundant hearths found in MSA sites, which stimulated speculation on plant use and the use of fire to manage local environments. In particular, there is focus on the Howison's port, which is characterized by segments or crescents that we saw in the earlier slide. These were made on fine-grained materials. This industry was originally seen as Upper Paleolithic-like and transitional to the LSA. But there was a problem. The Howison's port disappears from the record and is followed by more typical Middle Stone Age assemblages. However, this idea of modernity in the Middle Stone Age stuck. Human fossils had pointed to Africa for the origins of modern humans, and genetic studies were confirming that all living humans can trace their ancestry back to Africa. The idea that the Middle Stone Age showed evidence of advanced, even modern behaviors gained support in the 1990s, especially with the announcement of these two bone assemblages associated with Middle Stone Age artifacts. At Bloombos, the points were associated with a distinctive Stilbe variant of the Middle Stone Age, characterized by these bifacial points, which Palavia also just showed us. Despite the fact that the associations and therefore the age of both these sets of points were questioned by other researchers, these finds stimulated further consideration of precocious artifacts in the Middle Stone Age and cemented the idea that we should find evidence of modern behavior within the Middle Stone Age. The gradual accumulation model for behavioral innovations during the Middle Stone Age was proposed. The proposal did acknowledge that something still changes 50,000 years ago, and that this intensification was the result of population growth combined with environmental deterioration. This led to increased population density, which affected the economy, technology, and social lives of the groups involved. The increase in population size would have been due to new technologies and new risk management strategies, such as long-distance exchange. This model was further supported by additional finds from Bloombos of engraved ochre and perforated shells that may have been beads. Other sites preserved engraved ostrich eggshell. These generally have been accepted as support for symbolic behavior and abstract thinking in our Middle Stone Age ancestors. A big question remains, however: how far back in time do these behaviors go within the Middle Stone Age? Is evolution gradual within the Middle Stone Age, or is there a punctuated appearance with the start of the Middle Stone Age? Within the Middle Stone Age of South Africa, the location of most of our examples so far, we find a complex ochre processing kit at 100,000 years ago, an interest in ochre and non-subsistence shells going back as far as 110,000 years ago. In the last 10 years, we have recognized that MSA people often heat treat silkrete by roasting silkrete cobbles in the fire to improve their flaking properties. This has now been generally accepted as good evidence of complex technologies within the Middle Stone Age. Heat treatment is now well documented in the late Middle Stone Age and has been identified in numerous assemblages, and the technology probably extends back to 164,000 years ago. Beyond these examples, however, early evidence for symbolic or complex behaviors is sparse. Beyond the oldest deposits of Pinnacle Point B, there's still 150,000 years, earlier years of Middle Stone Age. So far, the archaeological record of South Africa has dominated the conversation. However, as I regularly remind my undergraduates, Africa is big and it is not one place. North Africa, particularly Morocco, is also interesting because it has provided the largest sample of early modern humans, as we heard about earlier from Jean-Jacques Houblon, with some morphological characters that link them with the earliest fully modern humans expanding out of Africa and into Europe. The later Middle Stone Age of North Africa is often expressed as the Aterian variant, characterized by stemmed points and scrapers, bifacial foliates, and end scrapers. Turning focus to North Africa, at Tafraalt Cave in late Aterian context, excavators found perforated shells that were likely used as beads, based on polish from use wear and ochre residue. These are similar in form to those from Bloombos, although the procurement and potential manufacturing differ. In Morocco, the antiquity of interest in non-subsistence shells can be pushed back to 115,000 years ago into the Maghrebian Mousterian. At Contrebandier, small shells like those from Tafraalt exhibit use wear and ochre traces and may have been used as beads. These were found alongside larger shells also collected already dead on the beach, like those from Pinnacle Point 13B. Again, we can ask, how much further back in time in the MSA can we find similar behaviors? As we go back further in time, of course, appropriately aged deposits become rarer, especially those that have benefited from modern excavation practices. And we get to see these stone artifacts for the third time today. So one exception, which we've heard about earlier, is Jebel Arud. These deposits provide a lower boundary for the Middle Stone Age of the region and preserve evidence of a Levallois-based stone tool tradition and fire use. However, we have not yet found ochre or evidence of engravings or ornaments. From my current reading of the record, there is continuity from the late earlier Stone Age to the early Middle Stone Age. For example, late ESA people were already interested in using ochre, something that we find well established within the MSA, even the early MSA at Alorga Siley. However, other signs of complex behavior, such as ornaments, engravings, or even heat treatment, are extremely limited and not always well contextualized. However, to make this comparison robust, there is dire need for more assemblages from both the late ESA and early MSA from good contexts, especially those that preserve materials in addition to stone. As I have presented here, within the Middle Stone Age, there is strong evidence of increasing behavioral complexity, such that the later MSA is quite different from the earlier MSA. Moving from the Middle Stone Age to the later Stone Age, much of what has been said about the LSA is characteristic of assemblages that have accumulated within the last 20,000 years. There are unfortunately few examples of well-preserved, well-excavated, well-dated early later Stone Age assemblages, especially those with non-stone components. One exception is Border Cave, where the early LSA component preserves perforated marine shells, ostrich eggshell beads, and bone tools, dated to about 44 to 42,000 years ago. One challenge in further investigating these developments within the Middle Stone Age and into the later Stone Age is that many of these examples that I have mentioned are isolated. Generally, instances are few and far between, and interpretation is confounded by the archaeological challenges of building robust chronologies and preservation. A second challenge is that the evidence is especially sparse in the regions where expanding human populations would have left Africa. Further, we lack direct archaeological evidence of a demographic expansion 60 to 50,000 years ago. Something did change 60 to 50,000 years ago to encourage a population to expand out of Africa. But what and where? Was the population expansion found throughout Africa or just within the one region of the source population? In order to move forward, we need to develop better defined and more specific models that allow for the generation of testable hypotheses. We need to further refine the timing of these expectations and incorporate them into a regional approach. Variation between regions seems clear, and that's one of the things I think today's symposium has really highlighted is the variation that we see within Africa. And regions such as West and Central Africa remain virtually unknown, again, especially with regard to the non-stone components of their assemblages. And, of course, any behavior-based model needs to be well integrated with the data from human paleontology and genetics. And so I think symposiums like what has been organized today is a fantastic way to keep people working on different lines of evidence integrated, talking to each other, and updated on the types of data that are being produced. Thank you.
I'd like to take you all with me to South Africa, where today above the Rising Star cave system, it looks very much like this. It's beautiful weather there right now. In 2013, Rick Hunter and Stephen Tucker went underground at this site looking for bones. And what I'm going to show you is the video that they took going for the first time into a previously unknown cave chamber that we call the Dinaletti Chamber. This is Stephen Tucker descending down a very narrow squeeze that we call the chute. It's a 12-meter vertical descent, and you see here at the base bones exposed on the floor of the cave chamber. This partial skull that you saw there in that video, this mandible that clearly from the photographs that they brought out of the cave looked like a hominin mandible, not a modern human. It was interesting enough for my friend Lee Berger at the University of the Witwatersrand to organize an expedition to see what these bones were, to recover them, to bring them out of the cave, to study them, and to try to understand them. It looked to us like there might be a large part of a hominin skeleton in the bones that we saw on the surface. And that was big news. But this posed a big challenge because the Rising Star cave system has a number of very narrow constraints in it that make it very difficult to pass. And in particular, the one above the chamber with the bones, called the chute, is a 12-meter vertical drop that has a minimum width of 7.5 inches, 18 centimeters. It was going to take some extraordinary scientists to get through this, and Lee, on a Facebook call, found some extraordinary archaeologists who were capable not only of the underground skills and the climbing skills necessary to get into this cave chamber, but also the excavation skills necessary to recover and document the bones there. One of these people, Lindsay Hunter, second from the right, is a staff member here at CARTA now. She's in the room. Several of the others have worked with us continuously since 2013 in various aspects of the project. Becca Peixoto at the Perot Museum of Nature and Science in Dallas right now is curating the first exhibition of the Homo naledi material in the United States. Elia Gertoff, Ellen Feuerriegel, Marina Elliott, who's for a long time coordinated all excavation work in Rising Star, and on the very right, Hannah Morris. This work is done by a team of more than 100 collaborators around the world. And I'm going to try to share some of the big picture aspects of it. I want you to know that this work is not possible without the tremendous collaboration and wholehearted helpfulness and just spirit for the work, both in the field, underground, and also in the laboratory, of these extraordinary people. And I'll point out many of them. Some of them are here in the room with us. So in November of 2013, the expedition spent 28 days underground recovering fossil remains in the chamber. What looked to us from the surface like possibly the remains of one skeleton turned out to represent the remains of many, many individuals. And you see here the excavators Marina and Hannah working on a bone bed that we exposed very rapidly. All of our work during the first couple of field seasons were dedicated to excavating approximately 20 centimeters of depth in an area of about 80 centimeters on a side. In that area, we recovered more than 1,500 hominin specimens, representing a minimum of 15 individuals. Study of these specimens in the laboratory convinced us over the course of a couple of years that we were looking at something that we'd never seen before in the hominin record. This was a new species, not like other hominins that we'd found so far, and our team named the new species Homo naledi. I'll give you a brief tour of what Homo naledi is like. It's different from us in many respects and yet similar. Its hands, for example, have fingertips that are broad, which are great for exerting a grip through the fingertips. It has wrist bones that are configured more like modern humans and Neanderthals than other earlier hominins, but its fingers are also very curved in its bones, which suggests that it was using them on a curved substrate while it developed, and that suggests that climbing was very important to its behavior. Its feet are mostly modern human-like in their proportions, in the presence of a longitudinal and transverse arch, and yet the lateral toes are a little bit longer on average than ours, and the arch is a little bit flatter than ours. Its brain, between 450 and 600 cubic centimeters in the specimens that we've recovered, is around a third the size of modern human brains. This is similar to earlier hominins like Australopithecus, and not very much like most other members of the genus Homo. Across its skeleton, it exhibits a mosaic of traits, some of them very much like modern people, and some of them very much like very early hominins and not very much like us. Its shoulders are configured to be reaching upwards very easily. That seems like a climbing feature. Yet its legs are very long and look like they're really well made for striding. Its pelvis is a little bit flattened and more flaring, similar to some of the earliest hominin pelvis, like Lucy's. And yet its hands and its jaws resemble our genus in most respects. Its teeth are human-like in size, and yet they're very primitive in their anatomy. It's an odd combination. I wanted to put this slide up here to remind me to tell you that we've recovered the remains of individuals of all ages, from neonates through toddler-age individuals, young and older children, through young and older adults. The distribution of ages in the sample that we have now, which is stretching up to around 25 individuals in the cave system, is very much like Neanderthals and early Homo in terms of not very much representation of older adults. But uniquely, we have a very high representation of children in the site, and that gives us some important insights into the development of this species, including the fact that its dental development appears to have progressed in a human-like pattern, not very much like earlier hominins and other non-human primates, early canine development relative to the molar eruption. And so it's a very unique combination of things. Our team didn't stop exploring in the cave system in 2013, and Rick Hunter and Stephen Tucker rapidly identified a second cave chamber in the system that had hominin material. Over the course of 3 years, our team, led by Marina Elliott, recovered material from that second chamber, the Lacetti chamber, which is 130 meters through the cave system from the first, the Dinaletti chamber. It's very clear that these hominins were using large parts of this underground system and were quite familiar with it. In the Lacetti chamber, we recovered the really impressive skeleton of an individual of Homo naledi, which we named Neo, in addition to parts of at least two additional individuals. And so we have an extraordinary situation where multiple parts of the cave system are representing a previously unknown hominin in a situation that we'd never found them before in the continent of Africa. Our work to date the site took some time. Eventually, we were able to sample directly from the Homo naledi teeth themselves, in addition to geological samples in the Dinaletti chamber, to narrow down the range of dates for this hominin fossil sample between 236,000 and 335,000 years ago. For a hominin that has a brain a third the size of ours in Africa, this was very surprising to us. It means that Homo naledi was there at the same time as our immediate ancestors, early humans, early modern Homo sapiens. No one guessed that we had to share the continent of Africa with something that was not very much like us at the same time that our species was originating. That raises many interesting questions. And I'm here to tell you today that I'm going to discuss some of these questions, and they're questions that I do not have the answers to. I have a lot of information that's interesting with respect to these questions and that makes me think very hard about some of them and that wakes me up at night sometimes and certainly wakes up my collaborators if I'm not the one waking them up saying, why isn't this done yet? So you've got these great questions and I'm going to review some of them. The first and most obvious one is, if Homo naledi's there 250,000 years ago or so, and it's got hands that look like they're really well suited to making tools, what kinds of artifacts are associated with it? Are they making the same kinds of artifacts as Homo sapiens at the same time? Now, when we talk about the Middle Stone Age in Africa, which is this time period in terms of the archaeological record, oftentimes people think about later aspects of the Middle Stone Age, famous things like the geometrically incised designs on this block from Blombos Cave, things like the great diversification across Africa of different point styles. This is in a figure from Sally McBeardy and Allison Brooks, and Allison's here in the audience with us. This is a famous thing about the Middle Stone Age, that you have this regional diversification. It is only relatively recently that we've developed some more insight about the earlier phases of the Middle Stone Age, as the Levallois manufacturing technique is really starting to take over from large cutting tools in earlier traditions. These are the Jebel or Hood tools, which we saw earlier today in Professor Ublan's talk, and they're from Morocco, and this is a really unique case in Africa where we have a very early Middle Stone Age that's associated with skeletal material of a hominin in a stratigraphic layer. So we know that, oh, they're the same time. This seems like they're probably associated with each other. There are almost no fossil associations for other Middle Stone Age, earlier Middle Stone Age assemblages throughout the continent. For example, these hafted points from Katupan in South Africa are among the earliest known in the African continent, before 400,000 years old. Who made them? Was it Homo naledi? We don't know. And this creates a problem for us. How do we tell when there are possibly two cultural hominins in the same continent, who made what? We don't know. These pigment blocks from Olorgasylae, again, Allison's work, are among the earliest uses of pigment anywhere in the continent. And what Olorgasylae is also known for is a much earlier deposit, more than 800,000 years old, including lots and lots of hand axes, including this extraordinary pavement of hand axes that the walkway is built around there. Those hand axes are coeval with a hominin specimen from Olorgasylae that, when Rick Potts described it, said, well, this looks like a frontal bone that might be a very small Homo erectus. In today's context, this looks like a ringer for later 250,000-year-old Homo naledi. When we look at small-brained hominins in Africa, they're associated with, in temporal terms, lots of different technical abilities. The question is, how can we pin down who made these things and who's responsible for them and whether they interacted with each other? This is a serious question. How did Homo naledi manage to coexist with other much larger brain hominins for as long as it did? We don't know. When we established the earlier part of the Homo naledi ancestry, like where did it come from, the tool that we have to do that is with phylogenetic analysis. And I'm showing you here a phylogenetic analysis from Monodembo and colleagues, including Mark Collard, who's introducing us all in the room, that shows their favored result was that Homo naledi was connected to Neanderthals, modern humans, and other larger-brained species of Homo, including Homo antecessor. If that's true, that would put the origin of the naledi lineage earlier than the date of the antecessor fossils, which is around 800,000 years ago. So it makes the naledi lineage something like 900,000 to a million years old. However, the mixture of anatomy of Homo naledi makes it very difficult to be confident about how it's related to us. Another analysis by Debbie Argue and colleagues, they were looking at the relationships of Homo floresiensis and flores, but they did so by looking across the whole skeleton at traits, and naledi is a really great sample for that. In their favored analysis, naledi was connected to the fossils from Dimonisi, Georgia, which are very early examples of Homo erectus, or in this analysis called Homo georgicus. If naledi is connected to those fossils, then its lineage might be more than 1.8 million years old. We don't know how long this branch of our phylogeny was hanging out in Africa in coexistence with other species. And it raises the question of how did all this coexisting happen? We've heard already today from a couple of people about the need to explain isolation in an African continent where it's clear that anatomical diversity among large-brained hominins is very great. We have a small-brained hominin that existed throughout this entire time period. Here's a modern human. And you guys have heard a couple of times already today, and I'll briefly review. We sort of think we know what the ancestry of modern humans looks like. You have these early anatomically modern forms that existed within the last 200,000 years. Before that, in Africa, you had fossils that many people have described as early Homo sapiens, but not modern, that existed before 250, back to maybe 400,000 years ago. And across that time and earlier, back to 600,000, you have some very archaic-looking hominins that many people have called Homo heidelbergensis, or some Homo rhodesiensis. The Bodo fossil there at the bottom is an example of that. And that looks like a gradual pattern. It's become apparent that this is a very diverse group. And in the middle of that diversity is a species that nobody expected to find. How is this coexistence possible in an African ecology that, as large as Africa is, we think of ourselves as the ultimate competitors? We're supposed to be driving all these things to extinction. And they're doing fine. That raises the question of whether Naledi is part of this network of mixture that existed across Africa. And I'll give my best attempt at this mixture. And you're going to see some genetics later today. This is drawn from genetics. And so I just want to illustrate that we've got a complicated tree of humans. And at the bottom of this tree, I've illustrated here Neanderthals and Denisovans. You're going to hear a lot about them later. In a paper that just came out yesterday, Alan Rogers at the University of Utah and colleagues have pointed out the possible existence of a super archaic mixture into the ancestors of Neanderthals and Denisovans. So there's complexity in their origins. If we look at Africa, we see equivalent complexity. We see the diversification of today's African groups starting before 300,000 years ago. And archaic African groups, as different from today's people as Neanderthals and Denisovans, that existed and contributed into recent African populations. Who were these people? A lot of times, people look at the stem of this, who's the common ancestor of us and Neanderthals, for instance, and say, well, that's something like Bodo, something Homo heidelbergensis-y. But of course, that particular fossil or others like it might be off to the side somewhere, one of these archaic groups. We look at the earliest members of our own species, things like the Jebel or Hood specimen, and say, well, maybe that's sort of rooting Homo sapiens in some way, but we don't have any genetics. Maybe it's also off to the side in some way. When we talk about Homo naledi, I'm not going to put it at the root of Homo sapiens, but is it one of these archaic branches that existed that maybe contributed to humans? Does the mixture between these possible populations explain something about the anatomy of Naledi and its unique mixture? Or is Naledi off to the side, totally separate? Or is it deeper rooted, one of these super archaic branches? We don't know. It's a fascinating question. It's one that drives us. Finally, how complex was this behavior that led Naledi into these cave chambers? A lot of people have looked at this as maybe an early example of burial. And when we look at these sites and say, why is it that this hominin is there in isolation, in abundance, there is something very interesting about it. We're studying the bones to try to determine this, and we're back in the cave trying to find answers. This is Marapeng Ramalepa excavating the base of the chute in 2018. You see here Becca Peixoto suspended over a ladder excavating what became, very clearly, another feature, which is an articulated hominin specimen that we've brought out of the cave in a plaster jacket we're now studying. Our further explorations in the cave system have found additional instances of Naledi material, including additional fine spots deep into very narrow cracks off of the main Naledi chamber in places that our team has to wedge themselves sideways and reach down toward the floor, suspended off of the floor to reach. It's clear that this hominin was spending a lot of time in this cave, that it was very familiar with the deep parts of it, and that the cave was something interesting and special in its behavior. And that says something about complexity. Understanding that, how it's connected to us, what it might mean, whether it's connected to ritual or other things that we've considered to be uniquely human, is something that we're going to take a long time to try to understand. And so it's an exciting moment because we're finding these unexpected things, and that's always exciting, but it also means that we have so much left to do. I hope that all of you will follow us as we continue this research and as we continue to make more discoveries in the Rising Star Cave system. Also, I hope that all of you who are out there digging, keep your eyes open. Because there's more of them out there. And I think that we're going to see many more of them very soon. All right. Thank you, everyone. I appreciate it.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.